The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler.
This is the BioRevolution Podcast, Nature's Origami DNA Nanotechnology, today's story. So it's basically about the general notion of looking at DNA and treating DNA as programmable material. In that sense, we'll talk about chances, roadblocks, and this time origami, as the title indicated as well. Hello, Izzy, how are you?
I am excellent. Really excited to talk about this today because this is a whole realm of new things that I didn't know about. And the more I read, the more exciting I find it. So I'm looking forward to diving into this.
We have Marco Lolaiko with us, joining us from Copenhagen, originally from Italy, I suppose, who holds a PhD in biophysics and is an expert in nanotechnology. DNA is with us today. We'll introduce him properly in a minute, but as always, we start with our quotes. What did you bring, Izzy?
Yes, I brought something on nanotechnology in general from Eric Drexler, who is a nanotechnology pioneer, who says the slightly, how you say that, like circular quote of, we know the basic principles of molecular machinery will work because they do work, which I think is interesting. But I think when it comes to DNA and especially DNA nanotechnology, that is something I could subscribe to. And the other one is from Michael LaFosse on origami. And he says, in the hand of an artist, a piece of paper becomes a world of possibilities. And again, I would say, when it comes to DNA nanotechnology, yeah, we have a world of possibilities. And I think there are a lot of cool things that you can do with DNA, except for using it as an information storage, which I was actually not that aware of. So I'm really looking forward to talking to Marco about that. And Marco, besides from having a PhD in biophysics and being an expert on DNA nanotechnology, is also a startup founder. And he is also a science writer, and he writes this excellent newsletter, which is called Plenty of Room. And we need to quickly hear about the title in a second, what that references. But here he talks about DNA nanotech, but also about AI-based protein design, some RNA. RNA is also very cool, but I think we only have time for DNA today. So Marco, welcome to the Viral Revolution podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Excellent. Maybe could you tell us very briefly the Plenty of Room? This, I want to say what it's a reference to, but I don't want to say something stupid. So I'll leave it up to you to explain it.
Yes. Yeah, it's a Feynman quote from this famous speech, there is plenty of room at the bottom. That is, you know, someone considered it, you know, like one of the bases of nanotechnology. It's not really, you know, but it's definitely, Feynman was definitely very good at capturing attention. So yeah, it's a Feynman quote.
Yeah, it's funny because we started our last episode where we talked about the brain also with a Feynman quote. So I thought actually this is the reference, but sometimes, yeah, you mix up things. So I didn't want to say it wrong, but happy that we can agree that this man produced good quotes.
For sure.
I got things wrong through quoting this time as well, because I thought you, Marco, would be an artist, an origami artist, not a scientist.
I wish. My artistic skills are not that high, unfortunately. And it's always on my to-do list to do some actual, you know, real-life origami instead of like the nanoscale stuff only. At some point, I have to do that.
You haven't.
Not really. I have a lot of like sale things on Instagram that I want to try.
Okay. Nice.
So guys, let's try to dig into the nano, the particularly small world of DNA and nanotechnology. Where does it come from? How does it work for an outsider, the non-scientist, which is me? Please try to explain it to me. I don't have a clue.
Should I go?
Yeah, please.
Okay.
Perfect. I have like only the hint of a clue. So
yeah, DNA nanotechnology is when you want to create materials or structures, or you want to create machines. Machines, I think, is a good way of thinking about them at the nanoscale. So it's always like this classical comparison. You have, you know, like your hair that is very thin, right? And like the nanoscale is like 1,000 times smaller than that. So we're talking about very small. And in our case, we want to use DNA. We want to use DNA, but not like as generally one thinks of it as like a genetic material, because that's what, even for, I have a molecular biology background. So even for us biologists, that's what mostly you think about. You don't really think about it's like, okay, you know, it's something that is like real, is an actual material, and you can actually use it for that. And the most important property, I guess you can say, of DNA that makes it like a, such an interesting material is that you can program it and then it will just self-assemble. And it's very reliable. Like, we know how it works. We know that A will bind to G, C will bind to G, and will bind to T. And that will work. Yeah. So that's pretty much what like the basic understand is like you have strands of DNA, they will find each other in solution, they will bind to each other, and you know how they will bind to each other. So if you want to have a lot of them, that will form bigger structures, and then you want to use this big structure and put like proteins on that, or you want to have like maybe just, you know, two strands that bind only if they find a specific biomarker, let's say, and then they start to fluorescent, for example. You know, these kind of things. That's pretty much in a very, very small nutshell, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, before we talk about use cases, of course, we have to determine easy. Do we know when this originated, where it comes from, when people started thinking about stuff like that, and kind of the birth date of this technology?
Okay, the birth date, I think Marco has to help me with, but I think it was a paper in the 80s by Ned Seaman, who was, and I really like that because we had crossover episodes too already where art meets science. So having this scientist getting inspired by art and vice versa. And also here he was actually, or at least the myth goes, that he was inspired by an M.C. Escher painting. So I think most of our listeners will be familiar with these like staircases that are a conundrum kind of, and apparently he took his inspiration from that. So that I think is pretty cool. And I think that is an interesting part of this field, that DNA, and this is why I said in the beginning, I mean, it's of course a material for information storage, and in the nanotechnology it can also hold information, but it can also be used irrespective of this information storage. So we're not talking about per se changing genes, changing our genetic material in cells. We can use DNA just as a structural material, like a mini plastic or something like that. And this, I think, is pretty cool. That said, I mean, you could also encode some information at the same time and make it even more exciting there. Marco, correct me if I'm saying it wrong, but I think the inception of the field was in the 80s, but then the really big milestone came with the inception of DNA origami. That was, I think,
2006.
Yeah, 2006. So what would you say? I mean, DNA origami is kind of the coolest thing in DNA nanotech.
Well, I mean, I did do my PhD on DNA origami, but maybe I shouldn't say this. But yeah, DNA origami definitely made everything more approachable. DNA origami is a very simple technique to actually do practically, you know, in the lab, while other types of assembling are a bit more fragile, they're a bit more delicate. You have to be more careful. The great thing about DNA origami is that you don't need to be super precise with a lot of things. It has a lot of room for error. And I think that's why after, 2006, there was really like an explosion in DNA nanotechnology. And it's also probably because, as you said, Ned Seaman had the idea in the 80s, but it took him like a good long time to actually do something about it, because it was also that at the time DNA was very expensive to just make, and it was very hard to make, right? But then things improved. Now we can make any DNA. You just go and you order it. DNA origami is still expensive because you need a lot of DNA, but you can just order it. At that time, you had to actually make it yourself. I have absolutely no clue how to do it, for example.
Poor scientists back in the days.
Yeah, exactly.
Life got a lot easier.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know if anyone ever made like an origami structure out of DNA, like the crane, the famous one? That would be this typical origami shape, or?
Have I seen a crane around? I'm not sure about that. But my old, my PhD supervisor, he did do like a bunny out of DNA. So that is also pretty funny.
And I think the Nature cover back then was a smiley made of DNA,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, it's cool to make, but also a little bit useless, right? So
I'm not sure about it. I mean, a smiley might not be the most optimal surface shape, but it is a surface, right? You can put stuff on it and then you can see where it is, because it's a 2D surface. It's reasonably straightforward. We know how to do that because of also other fields, right? So if you put like gold nanoparticles, or if you put like, you know, strands of DNA sticking out, you can see if you have like, yeah, you're looking for some DNA in a sample, you can see if it binds there. So is it the most, like, do you need to have a smiley on your, you know, chip for DNA detection? Probably not, but maybe it's not really the worst thing that you can put there, to be honest. So, yeah.
What would you say, like, both from the, I mean, from all the structures you've seen, and I think based on that you write this newsletter where you come across all different types of DNA origami structures or general DNA and nanotechnology, what would be the coolest or the most exciting structures made so far? And maybe starting with the non-moving things, but the static types.
I mean, there are, of course, there are a lot. And depends. Now, that's also like the interesting part. Now, DNA nanotechnology is really coming into its own as a field. So you do get like a lot of different like approaches. For example, there are people, or for example, what I did during my PhD was I was trying to make a specific type of DNA origami nanostructures. It is wireframe nanostructures. Generally, you have like very blocky structures, but you can also use more like open structures, like, you know, like bridges. They use like wireframe, this kind of stuff. And those ones can have some specific improvements, like the advantages. For example, you can make them bigger using the same amount of material, which can be helpful. But some other people are just saying, no, I want to use these block materials, these block structures, and I want to just make them huge. And how do you do that? You combine a lot of them. Hendrik Dietz in Germany has worked a lot on
he's
that.
He's from TU Munich,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. Exactly. They worked a lot on that. They made something that is very big. They mostly use like triangular structures. So then you get that everything is pretty much like geometrical shapes. And it's pretty cool to look at, in my opinion.
Can I ask in the realm of nanotech, how big is huge?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, could I see it with my own eyes, or is it still?
I mean, if you have very good eyes, I'm not so sure. I have glasses, so maybe you have better eyes than I do. That could be. No, I mean, so it's also like a little bit hard. Like we're talking probably still, I would say maybe up to like a micrometer scale. And it's also like a little bit hard because that's also why DNA nanotechnology is a little bit different than like normal nanotechnology. Because normal nanotechnology are often thinking about 2D surfaces. Like, for example, chips, right? They're all 2D. Now they're starting to try to make 3D structures. DNA origami doesn't have that limitation. Actually, you can make 3D structures reasonably easy. But of course, then it becomes a little bit hard because you have to be like, you know, you have like a very, very long, thin semiconductor thing that is very long in one direction, is very thin in the other one. Yeah, often you might have like round structures. They are lower than micrometers. It's very hard. Some people are trying it, and there is some work on that. And that as well depends a little bit what you are doing. We can do micrometer-sized surfaces, for example, just repetitive. Like you can imagine, like, you know, a sort of like lattice. And those ones is possible to do. And some people are working on that because, yeah, once again, those can be very useful for sensing applications of all kinds, or, yeah, possibly electronics. There is all this kind of stuff that can interact with other things. They need, like, you know, very, very big surfaces there. But it becomes, like, a little bit hard to make it too big stuff. But my dream would be to make actual things, like, you know, that you can touch. That would be pretty funny.
Be very cool.
We were talking about the fun part intensely right now, and I can't wait to hear more about the tech applications, but this is a BioRevolution podcast, and therefore we have to talk about the biotech applications that are possible. So far, my understanding is, okay, we have structures, we have the fun part, but where's the use cases?
Yeah. I mean, I also have a biotech background, so that's pretty easy for me to understand, actually. Because actually, I find that the non-biotech applications, since that are way out there, by the way, are much more fun. But yeah, for biotech, definitely there is a lot of work. The closest ones that I can see, there is even some commercial products, is in imaging. So for example, fluorescent imaging. I think that the best use for DNA nanotechnology, at least for DNA origami, because there is also, of course, like a slight difference between nanotechnology and DNA origami. DNA origami is probably the most common technique, but DNA nanotechnology also has some other parts. But for DNA origami, that you can make big structures and they're very addressable. So you know exactly where you are going to put something. So for example, this is a huge thing for imaging, because if you want to figure out the resolution of your microscope setting, right, you want to know, okay, I have this fluorophore and another fluorophore at 10 nanometers apart. And can you actually see that they're true fluorophores? So you see just, you know, just a giant blob, right? And that one, it's very hard to do with other techniques. A lot of techniques tend to make, you know, like random distribution of things, while for DNA origami, you can actually know, okay, yes, that is going to be there. And then there is a lot of work in diagnostic because, well, if you're looking for nucleic acids that can be DNA or can be RNA, it's pretty straightforward, you know, that you can have even like a reasonably simple, but in theory, you can just have like a simple setting where you, if something binds on one strand and another strand, it will link them together. And then maybe you have a fret at that point, you have fluorescence at that point, and then you get like recognition. And then you can also have that you can do signal amplification at that point, because you can have that instead of one fluorophore, like in a lot of, like, for example, antibodies, often is very hard to have more than like one functional thing that aside from the binding. But with DNA, you can have just a lot of things that self-assemble, and at that point you have a huge signal amplification.
So that would be for just recognizing, for example, disease proteins. Could that work? Like, how specific would that be? Could you say that would work also, for example, for detecting like a rare disease that has a different genetic product? So how...
The nice thing about DNA nanotechnology is it's very versatile. For example, you can combine it very easily with antibodies. You can have, you can combine it with small molecules. You can use aptamers. Aptamers that are also a kind of DNA nanotechnology, kind of not. Aptamers are just very short strands of DNA or RNA that can function more or less like antibodies. So they bind to things. And there, then you can have the same thing. You know, they can bind, well, mostly people try to find ones that bind, of course, to proteins, but you can also have them bind to small molecules. I know there are some aptamers for cocaine, so you can use it to detect cocaine. You can use it. Yeah, it's kind of like a very general tool, I think. That's also like one of its strengths. And it's also that often DNA is kind of inert, like it doesn't do much on its own, right? Often you have to add functions. Yeah, if you want to recognize a protein and you have like your DNA origami, you have to add something on it. It can be an antibody, it can be simply an aptamer. Aptamers are, yeah, just very easy to implement in these things. But at the same time, it also means that it's very inert. It will not do much. It might bind, you know, a bit randomly because of surface charges and things like that. But aside from that, it doesn't do much. Actually, there is even some data that show that it's not even immunogenic when you have like
interesting big structures. That was a question that I had.
And because that's going back to the biotech applications, that's definitely also somewhere that the people are trying to use DNA origami for drug delivery. They're trying to use it to design vaccines. There's a Tista company, Dori Nano, I think it's called, in the US, that they, if I remember correctly, are trying to make cancer vaccines using DNA origami. And for these, the DNA origami, it's probably one of the best use cases for, of course, some diseases, because some cell receptors respond very well when there is like a very specific shape and size of binders. So that, for example, one of my old PhD mates in my old lab, he was using DNA origami to put six, because you needed six ligands at a specific distance from each other in a specific hexagonal shape, so then they could go activate DR5 on the cell, the death receptor 5 on the cell, and kill the cell. This would only work, he's a smart guy, this would only activate when the pH in the environment was below a certain level. And this was also because you can have DNA strands that open and closed based on the pH. That's DNA things. In that way, since the tumor sites, they have lower pH than the rest of the body, more acidic, they could control where, you know, the DNA origami structures would open and actually kill the cells.
You had a cool paper in your newsletter about the cancer traps, like DNA nanostructures that fish out harmful molecules from the tumor microenvironment. Like TGF-beta. The cool thing, and I'm like five steps ahead of this because this is all very early stages, but you could, of course, think of structures that even have dual purposes, right? That could act as a vaccine and could also counteract, for example, negative or anti-immunogenic factors like TGF-beta. And then you have like, you could I mean, this is the old dream of tumor immune oncology, where you have some cancers that respond really well and some that don't respond at all to these new drugs like Keytruda and co. And of course, turning these cold tumors into hot tumors, that is, of course, something that many biotechs are working on, some kind of strategy to enrich the immunogenicity of these tumors. That could be really cool. And there, for example, I see massive potential for this technology. That said, I mean, this is at the potential stage and has not gone beyond mice so far. I think also in the whole field of vaccine development, and this is another paper that you shared that looked really interesting for having non-specific immune response to HIV elicited or like potential HIV vaccine. I mean, we know that this is a disease that is still very deadly, even though there are good drugs, but there are, of course, I mean, a vaccine would be much better than having a treatment. This has so far not worked, even though people have been working on trying to find a vaccine for a very long time. So that could, of course, be if there would be a different strategy based on a different, more structural approach, that could, of course, be very, very interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's also what I was saying about, this is that the paper I was thinking about when I was talking about the immunogenicity of DNA origami. Because also proteins can do a lot of similar things that you could do with a DNA origami scaffold at the end of the day. They have some technical problems, of course. It's very hard to make very diverse proteins that assemble into a specific shape. You can do magic them, right? But proteins tend to create an immune response, simply because that's what we do. That's what the immune system does, right? But DNA origami, especially DNA, of course, it is a little bit immunogenic. Like you can have receptors that bind to DNA and then they don't like it and you get immune response. But probably since DNA in DNA origami is so densely packed, because it's very densely packed, it doesn't really interact with much in the cells. Also, they're pretty big. Like that they're big structures for like, you know, compared to like proteins, for example. So they're much, much bigger. So that also like, you know, it's the kind of things that at least I wasn't thinking about as much as a biologist. But when you have that GFP, most famous protein out there, right, is 2 nanometers of the diameter or something like that. And that's just the diameter of a double-stranded helices of DNA. Then you have that these structures are so much bigger. So, you know, like cells are not made to interact with them. That's probably why they don't really do that much.
So let's go from high potential when it comes to drug development and the like to all in science fiction and the tech and biology border. I mean, you mentioned batteries, talk about computers, storage, about computing systems. So really at the crossroads of biology and tech. What's going on there? I think it's going from high potential to really something that is a little farther in the not so near future, right?
Yeah. I mean, batteries is my own personal thing. I don't think there is anyone working on batteries, unfortunately.
But there is. Save the world, please.
Yeah. But there is a lot of work on, you know, 3D batteries, 3D. And it's, yeah, once again, like with like standard DNA, sorry, standard nanotechnology techniques, is very hard to do 3D structures and stuff like that. So there is actually some work on using like bio-based materials. I've seen some people already a long time ago using like phages and making structures out of them. But on the DNA computing side or DNA data storage, all this like sort of, yeah, I guess computing stuff, there is a lot of work. The DNA data storage, this is mostly still like basic, you know, okay, we have like a long DNA strand or like, you know, some DNA strands that they interact with each other, and then we put them somewhere and then we sequence them. The problem with that is that generally it works. And it works very well. You know, DNA is very good at being very stable. And there is a company, I don't remember which one it is, and they make some sort of like beads that are very similar to like amber beads, very Jurassic Park luminescent there. And then they put the DNA inside there, and that one will like just last forever in practice. But often these things are made for, you know, data that you want to keep forever. You know, if you want to store healthcare data of like, you know, a whole population, and you don't need to access them very often. But probably there will be a need for something faster. And I was reading a paper about using DNA origami for that. Now, I don't think that particular idea will work. because it's like was based on actually imaging every time your structures, and that's definitely not doable. But these structures are also pretty stable in the right environments. So yeah, I think DNA computing is going to go somewhere. I mean, data storage is already there. Like, there are companies, and you can, I don't know if you can, but like people, like institutions can go and store their data in DNA, and it will last for a very, very long time, because it's just what DNA is good at, gave information.
And I think two cool things about that is that we don't know what language people in the future will speak, but they will, I mean, if they exist, they will have DNA, so they will be able
to. Let alone the aliens, right?
And I think that there was a company or a project that sent like information about our world encoded in DNA into space. I hope I'm not making that up. And
I think that when they sent a probe, like in the a long time ago, there was something about DNA in there, but I don't remember what it was.
This is really cool. And I mean, just thinking about like the coding possibilities, you have like a digital code of 2, and here you have a code of 4. So immediately you increase the possibilities, and you have, this is what I find so cool about this topic, you have this dual quality that you have the information and the structure in the same material. And if you combine the two in an intelligent way, then you get both properties in one material. And this is pretty fascinating, cool. I have to say. One thing that we, I think, don't have time to touch upon, but we can do maybe a separate episode on that, is, of course, RNA, which is maybe less stable, but also can do a lot of cool things. But I think it might be a bit beyond the scope.
Yeah, and it's a little bit behind as a field, RNA nanotech. It's just because, yeah, I think that they had even, you know, there was even more problems actually synthesizing RNA until you have to first synthesize DNA, the DNA that you want, which was hard, and then you have to actually make it, like, you know, maybe not in vitro. And now we can do it, it's easy. Maybe a few years ago it wasn't that easy.
Yeah, I think maybe we can move a little bit towards where you would consider, are there any risks to this field, any shortcomings where you would, I mean, maybe thinking about the bigger risks, I quoted Eric Drexler in the beginning, who made up this famous gray goose scenario, which I think is being like recycled as the paperclip scenario, where AI wants to kill us by making paperclips. And back then it was a synthetic biology that just wants to create gray goo and kills the world in days, which I think, I mean, was a thought experiment, but was not very helpful for the field back then. But do you feel like for DNA, since it is a biological material, do you see any risks in using it as a nanotechnology material?
I mean, honestly, no. I mean, consider that these things cannot self-replicate by themselves for like a lot of reasons. Yeah, DNA is pretty inert by itself. Now, of course, you could use, like, you could do, like, you know, you could use any drug for bad things with malicious intent. You could make, I guess, that, you know, yeah, what I was saying earlier, right? If you want to make DNA origami that kill a cell because you have specific antibodies in a specific shape, you can do that. You know, it's like you could go and make antibodies to kill people, right? It's pretty much the same. I don't think that there is any, we're definitely not going to see DNA origami run away and
drown the world in cranes.
Yeah, it can't replicate itself. So, and while that would be cool, but it's just like, it's DNA is around, DNA does self-replicate, right? And we are all still here. Also, there are a lot of things that can degrade DNA. I mean, proteins eat DNA all the time, right? It's the problem with RNA, right? There is just RNAs everywhere. DNA is the same. There are DNAs a lot. There is DNAs in the blood, for example. It's one of the problems that DNA origami has to make drug delivery, is that it's not very stable. Maybe one day we will actually be making nanorobots that are very smart at the nanoscale, and they can replicate, and then they can kill us all. I mean, I think we're a long way from there.
I love it.
I think we're a long way from there. But yeah, I don't know.
I feel somewhat itchy. There's something under my, you know, I don't know.
Must be the nanorobots.
Yeah.
How far would you say are we from putting this aside from the evil nanorobots, but how far would you say are we from clinical applications?
I'm not sure I'm the right person to give a timeline. I know, and I talk with a couple of people that are moving towards clinical application, but it's slow. It's slow because, you know, it's just hard when you are in a preclinical phase. It always takes time. And also you have to really explain and really test everything, right? When you have a new antibody, right? Or a new protein that you want to bring to do your first clinical trial, you have to give a lot of data, right? Like a lot of data, right? And here it's even, you know, people are going to be even more skeptical because you have a sort of new modality, but it's not exactly anything super new. But at the same time, rightly so, I guess, people are conservative in these things. They don't just go because it's a cool technology. It is a cool technology. I'm pretty sure it will work. I don't think we will ever see, you know, like drugs that don't work because they were on top of a DNA origami. I think the problem will always be the drug, but it's not close. I mean, and I'm not, you know, to this kind of things that can tell you how long it takes.
Even if you are close, I mean, it's always hard to say, but it's not like CRISPR where you discovered the thing in bacteria and then 10 years later you have an approved therapy kind of.
No, I mean, I think there is also a lot less, I don't want to call it hype, but I think that there is also a lot less, maybe promise. CRISPR does have the potential, or, you know, any kind of genome editing does have the potential to change completely, like how we treat certain diseases, right? DNA origami probably won't. It will definitely improve, especially on the safety side, you know, because if you can have a drug that actually just goes where you want it to go and it doesn't go everywhere and gives you like infinite side effects, it will make treating pretty much anything better. But at the same time, you know, if you have a disease that you can't treat with, you know, let's pretend you can't treat it with an antibody, DNA origami will not change that. If you have like a disease that you can only treat by using cell therapy, DNA origami will probably not change that. But it also has a lot less risks compared to something like, you know, changing the genome of like a person. But once again, the industry is pretty conservative. So I do feel like there's sometimes this kind of like a bit different modalities, tools, technology, I'm not even sure how to call them, are put all on the same level. And it's like, yeah, they're not. I mean, cell therapy, genome editing, and, you know, like having practically what it is, just like a better nanoparticle, they're not all the same.
It's all the stuff that's a bit different that is grouped into.
Amazing journey. Thank you so much for this, Marco. Any closing remarks, anybody of you?
I have another prediction question. I'm sorry for asking all these. Do you think there will be a Nobel Prize waiting for one of the founders of the field?
So,
like for click chemistry, for example?
Yeah,
so you, Marco.
No, not me. Not me.
Literature for the newspaper.
Maybe. I have to go for that, or the peace one at some point. Mm. So Ned Seaman was the most likely candidate, and in my opinion, he should have gotten it, but he died a few years ago, I think 3 years ago now or something along those lines. And I don't know if I see, as it is today, someone that has done as much for the field that would get like a Nobel Prize, mostly because I feel like that everything would be just compared to the fact, okay, yes, but Seaman never got it. So I don't know. I thought that there was a possibility a few years ago. Now I'm not 100% sure, to be honest, because yeah, I just, you know, there is Paul Rothmund, there is William Shee, there are a lot of people that have done, you know, huge things in the field, but I think we are still too close to the fact that the person that like kind of started the whole thing, where, you know, also the person that everyone learned from was around, that I don't know if they are gonna be like, okay, yes, I don't know. I don't think soon. I think it's gonna be, and I could be wrong, maybe it's this year, this is the year. I hope so. I'm pretty sure that my old boss was often trying to lobby for the DNA origami Nobel Prize, but I don't know. I don't think this, I think it's going to take a few years. And also probably there will be, you know, maybe something big that will be the base. Because I think that now that person that, because it's still a very small field. There aren't that many labs. I know most of the labs and I don't have a good memory. So there aren't that many labs, but it will be cool to see. It will be cool to see because it's also like, you know, Nobel Prizes always are
accelerator
Exactly. It's always good for the fields. So it would be amazing to see it.
Very good closing argument. At that point in time when the Nobel Prize will be there and associated with the breakthrough in the technology, then we have to talk again, of course, in another episode. Thank you for now, Marco.
Thank you.
Thank you, Izzy. This was the BioRevolution podcast. Please feel free to like us on the podcasting platform of your choice. Make comments on Science Tales. Yeah, we don't have to repeat this every time, I think. T-A-L-E-S. It's important. Because
for the people who make it to the end, it's like a, you know, like a running gag.
It's like a running gag, yeah. So we should
need to hear it.
That's true. So comments on sciencetales.com. And we're in the midst of preparing the next episode. Please stay tuned. Thank you.